This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the widespread anger over the treatment of migrant children in U.S. custody forces a contentious vote in Congress. Is it wrong to call the U.S. holding centers for the migrants concentration camps? And a personal reflection on a photograph of a father and daughter dead in the Rio Grande. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Thursday night, Congress passed a $4.6 billion emergency border aid bill, but it wasn't the spending bill that many Democrats in the House say they wanted, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Public outcry for congressional action took hold after news reports told of horrific conditions in Border Patrol facilities where children were being held in overcrowded, unsafe, and unsanitary confinement. The Democratic-controlled Congress had passed a bill on Tuesday that included restrictions for the Trump administration's spending. However, the Republican-controlled Senate passed their own version of the bill without those conditions. With a vote of 305 to 102, the House on Thursday ended up passing the Senate's version despite objections from some Democrats. Among the Democrats, 129 members voted in favor of the bill, but 95 opposed it. San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro, a Democrat and chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, said he didn't vote on the bill because he was in Florida attending the debate of Democratic presidential candidates, but he said he opposed the bill and would have voted against it.
The money is supposed to go to address the humanitarian situation at the border, which is obviously very important, even though it's the president's policies that are causing a lot of the surge. His Remain in Mexico policy, which is causing people to try to make it back two or three times to present for asylum. The metering policy, which is creating even more desperation so that people are trying to cross the river and some of them dying or go into the desert areas and dying there. So this bill tries to address that, and there's some good parts of it, but there are also some problematic parts of it. For example, it gives money to the Department of Defense with very little strings attached. And we know that that means that Donald Trump could try to funnel that money towards building a bigger border wall, or he could use it to fund more ICE detention beds or HHS beds where they're detaining these children. And so there are parts of the bill that are quite problematic.
Can you help listeners understand why this bill passed despite some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, there was basically a face-off between the House and the Senate for a while. In the House, we passed a bill that had very strict guardrails about how the money could be used so that the things that I described, the concerns that I described, basically wouldn't happen, wouldn't be a problem. But the Senate passed a different kind of bill with less safeguards and also, like I said, money that would go to the Department of Defense, about $144 million, that becomes kind of a loophole where the president could redirect it for other purposes. And so we saw that as problematic. What happened was that basically Mitch McConnell said the House bill is not going to go anywhere in the Senate, and the White House said that the House bill wouldn't go anywhere. The White House would veto it. And so they basically were able to impose their will this time.
Were they, in effect, holding those children hostage?
Yeah, I think it put many of us who care about the humanitarian situation at the border in a very difficult position because you want to be helpful in relieving that situation. At the same time, you don't want to do anything that's going to give extra money to either build a border wall or to detain more kids in facilities, and many of them in Texas. And so folks were in a very tough spot. But overall, I'm against the legislation because I think that it needed to have stronger safeguards.
Moving forward, how are those safeguards going to be put in place? Speaker Pelosi was able to get a verbal commitment from Vice President Mike Pence. What is that worth?
Well, you know, unfortunately, what's been proven over and over in this administration is that nobody in the administration really can speak for the president reliably. The president has shown that he doesn't really entrust any of his aides or even the vice president with carrying his word. So I hope that it's worth something, but I doubt it.
Is the condition in these Border Patrol detention centers, are they going to improve?
With this funding, they should improve. But look, there is something very problematic when Customs and Border Protection, for example, won't even accept donations from the public to go into, to be used at the border processing centers, where these children now are being kept for days and days, and often in squalid conditions, terrible conditions. They should at least allow the public to make contributions, because many people have tried to go make contributions of blankets, of bedding, of food, and so forth, and they won't let the public do that. And so there's really a kind of cruelty at work here that needs to change.
But we're talking about a government that just passed $4.6 billion in an emergency spending bill for these children. We don't need people to donate, toothpaste and other items. We have.
No, you're right. No, listen, I'm not saying that it's the public's responsibility. But what I believe is that people want to make contributions. And in fact, when people make donations, they see a situation as a humanitarian situation. That's why after there's a tsunami or an earthquake somewhere, what happens? The Red Cross mobilizes and people make donations to the Red Cross because they see it as a humanitarian situation. I believe that one of the reasons that CBP doesn't accept donations is because they don't want the American public to see this as a situation where the public should be sympathetic to these people, where they don't want people to see it as a humanitarian situation.
Well, you're talking about a natural disaster. This is a man-made disaster, and some are saying we know which man made it.
Well, and I would agree with that, absolutely. Like I said, the policies of metering, the Oscar and Valeria, the father and daughter who just died a few days ago, and their photo was put up all over the country and all over the world, they were not allowed to present themselves for asylum because of Donald Trump's metering policy. That will be Donald Trump's legacy as president. I really believe that when historians look back 30 years from now, 50 years from now, that they will look upon that photo the same way that many people look upon the photo in Vietnam of the young girl who had just been burned across her body. That's what Donald Trump's legacy is going to be. So I agree. I think that his policies have a large part to do with why people are suffering so much.
Some of the language that's coming out of the White House about the situation, they're saying, look, here is a border crisis. The Democrats have said there is no border crisis, and now they're willing to spend billions of dollars in order to deal with it. What do you want people to know about how this is really rolling out?
There's a humanitarian crisis at the border. There is not an invasion or a kind of crisis that Donald Trump has described. He described a crisis based on people trying to invade this country and do ill to the American people, and that's a lie. These folks are fleeing very desperate situations in their home countries because of drug gangs, violence, deep poverty. And so there is a humanitarian crisis at the Texas-Mexico border, just like there's a humanitarian crisis in Europe because of Syrian migration, in Southeast Asia because of the Rohingya who have been oppressed and killed there. There's a humanitarian situation in South America because over a million Venezuelans have fled Venezuela over the last few years. And so this is not unique to the United States, but it's up to each country on how they treat those migrants who are fleeing oppression and desperation. And Donald Trump is treating them inhumanely.
San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro was a Democrat and the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, voted against the Senate's version of the emergency border spending bill Thursday night. She is critical of funding the agencies that are enforcing President Trump's immigration policies, including a pending mass deportation crackdown that could be enforced in just a matter of days. Ocasio-Cortez recently drew the ire of Republicans when she called the migrant detention centers concentration camps. She says the words accurately describe the conditions of holding facilities on the U.S.-Mexico border, including in Texas. Andrea Pitzer writes about the history of concentration camps in her book, One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps.
Well, for the book that I wrote about the 100-plus-year history of these camps, I defined it as the mass civilian detention of people without trial, usually on the basis of identity. That could be your political party or your religion or your race or your ethnicity, but it's something about who you are rather than anything that you've done. And so, that is a broader category than people tend to think of it, because when people hear the phrase concentration camp, they think of Auschwitz, and they think of death camps. What a lot of people don't know, sort of as the first step to clarifying all that, is that those death camps, those literal extermination factories that were put together, were a set of six camps that were put in mid-war by the Nazis specifically to kill people as quickly and efficiently as they could. And there was a whole other system that was different, that was the concentration camp system. That's what they called it, the Germans called it, that had been in place for almost a decade at that point. And the very first years of that system that started in 1933 don't look a lot different than a bunch of other systems that were also called concentration camp systems that came before. So there's almost 40 years of concentration camp history before we even get to Auschwitz. And those death camps, I want to underline, are totally different than anything else in history. There's nothing else that's come close to that kind of camps at the heart of an extermination that happened in the Holocaust. So I'm talking about something different than that when I'm talking about concentration camp history.
And to that point, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has issued a statement about these comparisons that people are having with the Holocaust and what's happening on the border. And they are trying to persuade people not to make those comparisons. They say that in a statement issued that they regard that these recent attempts to make these comparisons with the situation on the U.S. southern border to concentration camps in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, they're saying these are not, this does not reflect the position of the museum.
Well, it definitely doesn't reflect the position of the museum. You know, it's their job to memorialize the dead of the Holocaust, and I think that's perfectly fine and appropriate for them to be the last people that would use, you know, any of these phrases for anything else. But just to be clear, I'm not comparing anything to the Holocaust, to that period of death camps that is sort of unparalleled in history. And I don't think most other people are either. I'm sure there's some awful denialists out there or whatever, but that's not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who seriously have looked at this history. But there were, in fact, a whole bunch of concentration camps in the 1930s in Europe and in Russia that rose out of a tradition that had been around for quite some time. And the Nazi camps, you know, there was a lot of influence from the World War I internment camps that Germany had. People learned how to register with the police when they were told to. They learned how to turn themselves in when they were asked to get assigned prisoner numbers, to go willingly into detention, into things that were called concentration camps, with the idea that at some point when a crisis had passed, in the case of World War I, when the war would end, that they would be released. All around the world during World War I, on six continents, this kind of detention arose, and people were detained this way. And I think it really trained a lot of people to accept this kind of detention as normal in such a way that when the first Nazi camps happened, they didn't seem that different, and people didn't resist them, although certainly some people did. But on a widespread basis, they weren't shocking to the world. And I think it was this early concentration camp history that made them less shocking. But I think it's important to say most of what I'm comparing the current border situation to is not even those camps, but are actually camps from a decade earlier. From the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, there were camps in Cuba under the Spanish Empire. There were camps in southern Africa. The British were locking up descendants of Dutch settlers there that were known as the Boers. And in both of those situations, It was mostly women and children swept behind barbed wire. There were no gassings. There were no mass exterminations. There was no firing squad. They were kept in brutal conditions that were overcrowded, and there was not enough food in some cases. The camps were poorly sited in other cases. And in Cuba, you ended up with more than 100,000. Most people estimate about 150,000 civilians died in those camps. And in the Boer camps, about 27,000 people died in those Boer camps, and nearly 80% of them were children. And so it's actually the very first things that were called in newspapers and everywhere else concentration camps that were for civilians, that were not death camps in any way. That's the analogy that I think is most profound and accurate for what we're doing on the border. And even the issue of the soap that's come up, where, you know, we're talking about not having soap and toothpaste, that came up in the Boer camps. There was a radical who went down there to see the camps for herself from England. She went all the way to Southern Africa in 1900, 1901. And she went in, and the kids there weren't getting soap either, and she wrote the British letters begging them to deliver soap to these poor children to try to help keep them from getting diseases. And so these issues that came up in those first camps, we are seeing now, and I don't expect there's going to be 150,000 people dying like there were in the Cuban camps, but I think we're really underestimating how bad things could get if we don't figure this out.
The Cuban camp, just to explain, Cuba at the time was a province of Spain. They wanted to put down a rebellion. They were having trouble, and they had the idea to just round up all of the people and put them in camps. So anyone who is not in a camp is therefore someone who could be shot on sight.
Right. Basically, we are having trouble figuring out, the Spanish were saying, you know, we are having trouble figuring out where the bad guys are and where the good guys are, and this is kind of a guerrilla war, and it's hard to sort out, and we think some of these women and children may be hiding and feeding some of these guys as well. So the answer was burn everything down, you know, burn the houses down, burn the crops, just lay waste to the countryside, force everybody off of it, all the women and children off of it behind barbed wire, and then you know who you're dealing with is left. You're dealing with rebels, and you can shoot them. So what's interesting is the very first record we have of somebody contemplating this policy directly was from the Governor General of Cuba, who was saying to Spain, he wrote a letter to Spain basically saying, hey, these rebels, it's just going to come up again and again. We've been dealing with them for decades. And the only way I can see that we're going to win this is if we start shooting prisoners on a really committed basis, and if we reconcentrate, so reconcentración is where the name of all this came from, if we reconcentrate these people out of the countryside and force them behind barbed wire. And I'm not going to do it because as the representative of a civilized nation, it's just going to be horrific, and I won't do it. So Spain recalled that guy and sent in Valeriano Weyler, a general whose nickname was already the Butcher, and he happily instituted those policies.
These atrocities were being reported in the United States, and these, along with the Maine sinking, were used for the United States to as a justification to go to war with Spain.
Oh, yeah. It was, I mean, Americans were heartbroken at what was being done to these people. Americans gathered up dried beans and condensed milk, and the Red Cross was there. And that's part of why the Maine was even in Cuba to be sunk and sort of help trigger the whole war, was because there was all this American freight traffic that was heading down there delivering this stuff. So people remember, if they remember the Spanish-American War of 1898, they remember the sinking of the Maine being the thing that triggered it. But in fact, the thing that made America ready to go to war, the thing that drove Americans to want to help you know, defeat Spain in Cuba was the stories of the people dying in the camps.
But when the United States easily beat Spain in the Spanish-American War, liberated Cuba, also the United States acquired the Philippines, didn't we adopt some of those same tactics in order to bring some sort of stability to the Philippines?
Unfortunately, yes. At the time, McKinley was the president, and when he called for war with Spain, he described this policy of concentration camps as extermination and said it would lead to nothing, basically, but the wilderness and the grave. Yet, once we inherit the Philippines, he has a couple, you know, difficult nights of dark nights of the soul wrestling with what to do with the Philippines, because America hadn't really been an imperial power in terms of having a lot of colonies. There was some debate about what to do, but then it was decided we were going to keep it and we were going to not give it independence, the Philippines. And so we instituted our own concentration camps very much in the way that the Spaniards had in an effort to put down a rebellion. Now, they were only open 4 months because the conflict was shorter, but more than 14,000 people died in civilians. Again, not prisoners of war, but civilians died in those camps.
So the United States has a history with concentration camps. People like to play with words on this, particularly with the Japanese. Internment camps, were those concentration camps?
They were concentration camps. If you go back to that original definition I was saying of mass detention of civilians without trial on the basis of who you are rather than anything that you've done. And I think people think of that Japanese-American internment as kind of harmless. Well, they just had to go into camps for a while and then they came out. But they were forced to sell, most of them were forced to sell their possessions, their businesses in a really short time, a terrible loss. They lost all their property. Communities were shattered. They were given loyalty tests while they were in there, and if they weren't adequately supportive of the United States that had just locked them up, even though two-thirds of them or more were actual citizens with as many rights as you and me, if they weren't sufficiently loyal in their questionnaires, then some of them were targeted for even worse kinds of detention. And so I think that looking back, again, it's important to emphasize, we're not talking Nazi death camps, but you don't have to have Nazi death camps to be inflicting tremendous harm on civilians who haven't committed crimes.
Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calls these border detention facilities concentration camps. People react. They say, how dare you call these things that? That's not what they are. You say, you look at the definition of a concentration camp, then yes, it is. So now what?
So, If people out of real, honest, thoughtful wish to memorialize, this horrific, singular human tragedy of the Holocaust, don't want to use that term, then I've said it's fine to use irregular detention, to use extrajudicial detention. These are also accurate terms. However, it's really important, I think, for listeners to understand what we're replicating right now, what we are doing right now in the U.S. is repeating the early history of what were called concentration camps that led to just a tremendous amount of suffering. So, however people want to respond to that, I'm a journalist, I'm not an activist. One of the things that has happened with a lot of concentration camp systems, when you think of the big ones of the Nazi Germany ones, or in China after World War II, the labor camps that went for decades and decades, and there's still camps there. The Uyghurs in China, there are Muslims that are interned there, more than a million of them right now. In the Soviet Gulag, when people think of those kinds of systems, then the citizens of those countries had terrible difficulty standing up to that because they had very few freedoms. And here in the U.S., anybody who feels strongly about this issue, there's nothing stopping them from doing any of a million things, from calling a representative to giving money to groups giving legal aid to the people in these detention camps, to running for local office themselves, to, protesting. I mean, literally, the sky is the limit on what we can do. And so, sometimes people have come back to me and say, well, I feel really helpless. And I'm like, hey, you should read about some of these other places I covered. People there managed to do things even when it was totally illegal to do many of them. Whereas here, there really are a lot of options. So if people are concerned about it, there are things that they can do. And they can, the first thing to do would probably be find somebody who's doing the kind of thing you want to do already, because there's a lot of groups out there.
Andrea Pitzer is a journalist and author. She wrote the book One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. This week, we've continued to see the disturbing images coming from the detention centers on the southern border. The families keep making the journey from their home countries to the U.S.-Mexico border, risking family separation and more. They are driven by a desperation to flee violence and poverty. But for some, the journey brings a bleaker fate. This week, photographs of a father and his little daughter, who drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande, has created a tipping point for those who believe that the system imposed by the government to process asylum seekers while trying to deter them has finally broken down, a total failure. Texas Public Radio commentator Yvette Benavides shares her thoughts on that in this commentary.
Valeria was almost 2 years old when her parents made the difficult decision to leave the life they knew in El Salvador to travel north to America. They must have heard the stories about the wall that would keep them out if they didn't hurry, if they didn't risk everything to make the trek. They had to try. The U.S. promised an American dream and a fair shot for asylum seekers who followed the rules. When they arrived, they learned that they had to wait because of a practice called metering that limits the number of people allowed to approach border crossings to apply for asylum. The delay can span months. Valeria's father must have felt desperate. I imagine he made a game of it for Valeria. At such a tender age, she was easy to carry, to distract with the doll. She could hug Daddy's neck while they went swimming across the river. But once across and safely on dry land, she watched as her daddy jumped back into the water to help Mommy, and she followed him. The border they were trying to get to, the border between the United States and Mexico, is a policed border. That means it's an aggressive one, inhospitable, treacherous, with ever-changing rules of the game. The writer Kapka Kasubova writes in her book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe, that, quote, when a border is policed, it acquires a body, if not a human face. There's a related insidious ideology, she writes, one that is centralist in practice, and the belief that the center of power can issue orders from a distance, from a White House, say, and to do so with impunity. The periphery is sacrificed. What is out of sight of the mainstream is only a memory. Border zones, she writes, are always the periphery, out of the sight and away from the understanding of the mainstream. We didn't have tender age in our lexicon before, but for the last year, a solid year in counting, we have come to hear it daily. It was shocking to hear the term the first time and stomach the implications. Seasoned journalists wept on the air to say the words. Tender age. The words now make us think of Valeria and her father Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Together they experienced a merciless journey, and together they drowned in the Rio Grande, emerging on the bank of the river in Matamoros, Valeria wrapped up in her father's shirt, still clinging to him, her small arm draped around his neck. Kasubova writes that the border, quote, hums with an especially siren-like tone for children and parents lured by the possibility of a life free of violence, death threats, and poverty. Just by being there, Kasubova says, the border's an invitation. Come on, it whispers, step across the line if you dare, in sunshine or under cover of night, in fear and hope rolled into one. Supporters on either side of partisan ideologies like to quote the Bible as suits the du jour scandals and catastrophes in any given news cycle, the blips that we shake our heads over and that are promptly replaced by the next inconceivable disaster. With the debate over immigration policies and the dystopian horrors on the border, it's mostly those appalled by the humanitarian crisis roiling there who go often to verses from Matthew and the parable of the sheep. This is the same discourse where Jesus warned, if any of you put an obstacle before children, it would be better for you if a great millstone were fastened around your neck and you were drowned in the depth of the sea. As systemizing the neglect and torture of thousands of children goes uncurbed, that biblical millstone has somehow been transferred to hang around the collective necks of those who understand that seeking asylum is not an illegal act, who try to donate hygiene products and toys for the children, and are turned away with the blistering indifference of armed guards. 7 children have died in U.S. Customs and Border Protection custody in those squalid camps. Hundreds of tender-age children are still in cages, and the ferryman at the edge of the riverbank remains stony-faced, inured to the misery of the least of our brothers and sisters.
That was a commentary by Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides. She is professor of creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.